Osho, Tao the Pathless Path, Volume 2, talks and extracts from the Lita Zoo, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 7.
Bhagwan. Lut Saya asked the Master, "What sort of man is Yen Hui? For kindness, he's a better man than I am. What about Su Kung? For eloquence, he's a better man than I am. Su Lu? For courage, he's a better man than I am. Su Chang? For dignity, he's a better man than I am." Su Sai rose from the mat and asked, "Then why do these four serve you? Sit down, I will tell you. Yen Hui can be kind, but cannot check the impulse when it will do no good. Su Kung can be eloquent, but cannot hold his tongue. Su Lu can be brave, but cannot be cautious. Su Chang can be dignified, but cannot unbend in company. Even if I could have the virtues of the four men all together, I should be unwilling to exchange them for my own. This is why they serve me without misgivings."
The greatest enemy of religion is not materialism, but morality. Why? Because morality tries to impose spirituality. It is a conditioning. And religion can flower only from the within. It cannot be imposed from the without. Hence, morality creates an illusion of a false religion. Morality is a pretender. Morality is a pseudo-religion. It gives you respectability, but it does not give you understanding. It gives you a great ego trip, but it cannot give you humility. It makes you feel superior, but it doesn't help inner growth. And the man who feels superior cannot grow. He is stuck with the ego. Morality is a sort of decorating your ego. Yes, through morality you can cultivate great virtues, but you will never be virtuous. Through morality you can become very talented into certain directions, but those talents will remain unconscious. Morality cannot bring awareness, because morality is not based on enlightenment. The essential has to come from the inner. The essential has to grow like a tree. The essential is alive. The non-essential is imposed from the outside. Before we enter into this beautiful parable, two things have to be very clearly understood. First, there are two kinds of unity in life. One unity is mechanical. For example, a car. A car has a certain unity, a functional unity. But it is assembled. It comes out of an assembly line. You cannot assemble a tree. You cannot assemble a baby. They also have a sort of unity, but totally different. Their unity is organic. Car is mechanical. A baby is organic. Machine is mechanical. A tree is organic. You cannot put a tree together. It grows. It grows out of its own inner center. You can help at the most or hinder, but you cannot put a tree together. A car you can put together. You can assemble a car. Hence the car has no soul, no self, no center. It is a superficial unity. And the car cannot grow. It cannot give birth to new baby cars. The tree grows, can give birth to millions of trees. And the tree has a center. And the tree is run by the innermost center. When fall comes and the old leaves drop, who brings the new leaves? From where they come? From the innermost core of the tree, they evolve. If a mechanical part of the car is missing, you will have to put it in the car. The car itself cannot evolve it. It depends on you. It has no soul. It has no inner discipline of its own. If you cut a branch of a tree, another branch is supplied by the center. If you destroy a machine, nothing will be coming out. From the center, there is none. There is no center. Morality is mechanical. Religion is organic. This is the first basic thing to be understood. Morality is put together from the outside. Religion grows from the innermost core of your being. Religion comes out of meditation. Morality comes out of conditioning. Morality is enforced by others. Religion, you have to seek and search. Religion is an adventure, individual adventure. Morality is a social device. Morality is dominated by the politician and the priest. Religion is a rebellion. Very rarely a person is religious. And whenever there is a religious person, there is a great revolution around him. Moral people are ordinary people, as ordinary as the immoral, sometimes even more ordinary than the immoral. The immoral sometimes may have courage, but the moral has no courage. The immoral may have sometimes intelligence, but the moral has no intelligence. The immoral sometimes may be original, but the moral is always repetitive. Morality is the greatest enemy of religion because it is a pseudo coin. It pretends and it can deceive people. It has deceived down the ages. Millions and millions of people are deceived by morality, and they think when they have morality, they have religion. Second thing, morality is always relative. You can have more intelligence than somebody else, or somebody can have more virtue than you, somebody can be more courageous than you, or more cowardly than you, somebody can be more sharing, more loving, or you can be more loving than somebody else. Morality is comparative. Nobody can have more religion than you or less religion than you. Religion is non-comparative. When religion is there, it is simply there. Can you say Buddha has more religion than Jesus? Can you say Mahavir has more religion than Muhammad? Can you say Lao Tzu has more religion than Krishna? It will be absurd. The very statement will be absurd. Because religion is not a quantity. It is a quality of being. You cannot have more or less. There are no degrees. You can be more honest than somebody else. There are possibilities. You can be more a thief than somebody else. There are possibilities. But how you can be more religious than somebody else or less religious? Religion means awakening. Religion means you have come home. How you can be less at home than somebody else or more at home than somebody else? When a man has become aware, awareness is always total and complete, utterly complete. It does not come in parts. It comes whole. Hence it is holy. Religion comes whole. Morality comes in all shapes and sizes. You can have a family size morality, like toothpaste, a medium size. Morality comes in all shapes and sizes. Religion is just complete. Either it is or it is not. Sometimes people come to me and they ask, who is more enlightened, Buddha or Mahavir? The question is absurd. Who is more enlightened? Enlightenment means you have gone beyond relativity, so more and less cannot exist now. Who is more enlightened? Enlightenment means you have disappeared. And disappeared are all relative concepts. You are simply there, a pure isness. Whenever anybody becomes a pure isness, pure existence, primordial innocence, there is no comparison. To go beyond comparison is to become enlightened. So you cannot ask the question, who is more enlightened? The very question is meaningless. Religion either is or is not. This is the second thing to be remembered. Third thing, when religion comes, you are naturally moral. But the vice versa is not the case. You may be moral, you may not be religious. When you are religious, you are naturally moral. Morality comes like a shadow. A disciple came to Li Tazu and asked Li Tazu, what should I do, Master, to become enlightened? And Li Tazu said, you stand in the sun, walk, and watch your shadow. The man went out, stood in the sun, walked, and watched his shadow, came back, bowed down, thanked the master, and said, "You have showed me the way." Other disciples were very much puzzled. What has transpired between the master and this new man? And they asked later, and he laughed. He said, "It is so simple. I told him to go into the sun and walk and watch the shadow." And he understood the point. If the body walks, the shadow follows. The shadow cannot walk on its own. And even if you can manage that the shadow walks on its own, the body will not follow. There is no necessity. Morality is like shadow. Religion is the real figure. When religion is there, morality comes on its own. Has to come. There is no other possibility. But if morality is there, there is no necessity that religion should be there. You can become a moral person without at all becoming religious. You can have good qualities. You can be honest, sincere, true, non-violent. But that doesn't make you religious. If you are religious, certainly all moral qualities simply follow you. When you are moral, you have to manage continuously. Because those qualities have to be maintained, otherwise they will disappear. A moral man has to continuously manage his honesty. Because every moment there is the fear he may function dishonestly. The dishonesty has not disappeared. It has been repressed. It is there. It is waiting in the basement of his being for its own opportunity. And once the opportunity is there, it will assert itself with vengeance. It is there, and the moral person knows it well. He may be trying to be loving, but he knows the hatred is there boiling within him. He may be smiling, but he knows his eyes are full of tears. He may not be showing his anger, but he knows his heart is burning. He wants to kill. He may be praying, but really he wants to curse. He knows it. There is no way not to know it. You can deceive others. How can you deceive yourself? Even if you try to deceive yourself again and again, the reality will assert. And you will have to encounter it again and again. And you know, you can pretend that you are a very good man. But deep down you know how bad you are. That hangs like a stone in your neck, like a rock, keeps you pulled down. The moral person is dual. He is something on the outside and just the contrary on the inside. There is a continuous struggle in his being. He is split. The moral person is a schizophrenic. The whole earth has become schizophrenic because of moral teachings. Teach a person to be moral and sooner or later you will send him to the psychiatrist's coach. You are creating madness in him. The person is feeling angry and you say, "Don't be angry, anger is bad." Because Moses says so, or Muhammad says so, or Mahavir says so, anger is bad, don't be angry. Anger is coming naturally and you teach him. And great is the stake. If he becomes angry, he will lose his respect. He can be respected only if he is not angry. He has to pretend to get respectability. Look at people. They have lost their original faces. They are carrying masks. They are hiding behind masks. You can never be certain who is hiding behind. You love a person. By and by you find that it is not the same person you had fallen in love. Have you not observed it again and again? When you fall in love with a person, after a few months or even after a few days, if you are a great observer, you will find that this is somebody else. This woman is not the same woman. This man is not the same man that I had fallen in love with. Because you had fallen in love with the mask. Now by and by the reality becomes clear. When you live with a person, he cannot wear the mask 24 hours. It is heavy and he wants to rest too. And sometimes he is on a holiday. Even saints have their holidays. I have heard in a circus there was a man, and the circus managers used to claim that he is the tallest man in the world. Somewhere near about 9 feet tall. One press reporter went to take his interview. He was the tallest man in the world. Naturally, he had chosen Sunday because the Sunday morning was free to him. So he went there. And the man was lying down just in front of his tent, taking a sun bath. He was very much surprised. The face was the same, but the man was not 9 feet tall at all. So he asked, "What is the matter? You don't look to me more than 5'5". But the face seems to be exactly the same." The man laughed. He said, "Yes, you are right. I am the same person, the tallest man in the world." But he said, "What is the matter? You don't look me more than 5'5". He said, "This is my Sunday. This is my holiday. If you want to me see 9 feet tall, then you have to see me on duty." It is a managed thing. When you see the leaders delivering a lecture to the masses, it is a different face. When you see the priest in the temple worshipping, it is a different face. When you fall in love with a woman, it is a different face. She is trying to be as good as possible. But that is not reality. That is a managed reality. She cannot manage it forever. That's why wives are not so beautiful. Husbands are ugly. You know them. You have seen them in their holidays. Morality creates a division. The inner, the real, becomes hidden. And the outer, the false, becomes the manifest. This is one of the greatest calamities that has happened to humanity. Religion makes you one. It expresses the inner on the outer. Religion makes you healthy. Then your taste is the same. And you are never on a holiday, because you are always on a holiday. It is your natural quality. The fourth thing. A tree is alive. A machine only exists. It is not alive. A man of morality only exists. He is not really alive. You will not find vitality. You will not find radiance. You will not find a surging energy. You will not find him like a flood of life. He has to continuously curb his being, cut his energies. He has to live on the minimum. He is never a slave. He is always afraid. If he becomes too much alive, then the repressed will start asserting. He is always afraid. He keeps himself pulled down. He goes on holding himself. He never allows himself a total let go. Because a total let go literally means that which is repressed will suddenly erupt on the surface. It will be like a volcano erupting. So he has to keep himself at the minimum. He has to allow only minimum energy. Only then he can control himself. With the maximum energy coming in, he will be out of control. He will be thrown off balance. A man of morality just appears living. It is an appearance. Only a man of religion is alive. A man of religion lives at the optimum, and the man of morality lives at the minimum. Literally, at the minimum, you live like an impotent person. You cannot be angry, so you cannot love either. Because there is always fear. If you love too much, sometime anger may come in. When one energy is allowed total expression, other energies also get freedom. When you open your door for one thing, other things also will escape out. You cannot open your door. You have to be always on guard. Just think of the misery of a man who is always on guard, cannot relax. And a man who is always on guard is a tense man. A moral man is never happy. He may not be sad at the most, but he is never happy. He is never ecstatic. It has never happened. For millions of years, man has existed on the earth, but it has never seen a single exception. Never a moral man has been found ecstatic. He cannot dance, he cannot sing, he cannot rejoice. Because joy is freedom, and he does not know what freedom is. Ecstasy is going beyond yourself. And that is possible only when you move to your optimum. When you are aflame with great passion to live. When you love totally. When you are flooded with God. Then only ecstasy is possible. Ecstasy is not yours. Ecstasy is God dancing in you. You cannot allow God because you have not even allowed nature to dance in you. You have not even been natural. How you can be spiritual? Remember, spirituality is a higher stage of being natural. Spirituality is the ultimate flowering of being spontaneous. A moral person is never spontaneous. A moral person lives through the past. He has a character and he has to follow the character. He has a blueprint. He has a map and he always looks at the map and functions through the map. He never functions in the present. He is a dead man. He carries his character around him. His response is never a real response. It is only a reaction. A man of religion is responsible, not reactive. A man of morality is predictable because he has a character. You can depend. You know that he will be honest tomorrow also because he has been always honest. He will be honest even in circumstances where honesty is going to harm the other person. Where honesty is going to be destructive, even then he is going to be honest. You can depend on that. He has no freedom. He has no eyes to look into things. He does not respond to reality. He responds to principles. When you respond to principles, you are simply reactive. You have a program in your mind. You are like a computer. You go according to the program. Right or wrong is not the question. And the circumstances of life change every moment, and your principles are rigid. Your principles remain the same. Naturally, a man of morality never fits anywhere. He is unfit. It is very difficult to live with a moral man, because he is always unfit. He does not look at the reality, what reality is. He simply lives through his principles. Principles are more important than the reality. A religious man has no principles. Let it sink deep in your heart. A religious man has no principles whatsoever. He has only awareness. He looks into reality, and whatsoever is required, he responds accordingly. His response is spontaneous, not dominated by the past. Hence, a religious person is not predictable. You don't know what he will do. Even he cannot say what he will do, because it will depend on the circumstances. A slight difference in the circumstances and the response will be different. A religious man has no character. It will be difficult for you to get it. A religious man has no character, because character comes from the past. A religious man has instant consciousness. Or, to say the same thing in other words, a religious man has no conscience. He has consciousness. And a moral man has no consciousness. He has conscience. He functions through dead codes. He carries the commandments, and he always looks into his commandments and finds out a way how to behave. He is always unfit. He is never anywhere true. A moral man cannot be true, because he has a character. How can you be true when you have a character? If the circumstances are different, what you will do? You cannot change so easily. A moral man is very rigid. He has no dynamism. He is not flowing and fluid. He has a fixed identity. Things should be done only this way. He cannot do things in any other way, whatsoever the situation. The situation may have completely changed, but the things have to be done only in this way. One Zen master, Bokoju, asked a disciple, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" And the disciple remained silent. He closed his eyes and fell into deep silence. Bokuji was happy. And he said, "Good, good, I agree." But another master was sitting while this happened. When the disciple had gone, the other master said, "You agreed too early. I don't see." Call the disciple back. The disciple was called back, and the other master asked, "Tell me, what is the sound of one hand clapping?" And he again closed his eyes and remained silent. And the master laughed and he said, "Wrong, absolutely wrong." And Bokuju said, "Right, I agree with this other master." The disciple was puzzled. He said, "But why? Just a moment before, I had answered the same way through my silence and you had said right." And Bokuju said, "That was true in that moment. Now you are repeating. Now this cannot be true in this moment. Everything has changed." That was a response. This is a reaction. Now you have become fixed. When for the first time you have responded, there was no idea what you were doing. It came naturally. It came just simply, innocently. Your mind was not manipulating. Now, it is not a response of a meditative consciousness. It is mind manipulating. Now the mind knows the answer. Now the mind says, "Good." Again the same question. So the same answer. The master says the question may be the same, but the answer cannot be the same next moment. It will depend on 1001 things. It used to happen to Buddha every day. Somebody will ask, "Is there a God?" And he will say, "No." And somebody will ask, "Is there a God?" And he will say, "Yes." And somebody will ask, "Is there a God?" And he will keep silent. And somebody will ask, "Is there a God?" And he will say, "Don't ask nonsense questions." In one day, 1001 answers to one question. His chief disciple Ananda became very much worried. One night he asked, he said, "Master, the question is the same. You answer so differently, you answer so contradictorily that we become puzzled, confused." Buddha said, "I have not answered you. You need not listen." Somebody had asked a question, the answer was given to him, not to you. And the questioners were different. How the question can be the same? And the time was different. And the situation was different. One man who had asked, "Is there a God?" was an atheist. He didn't believe in God. I had to say to him, "Yes." I had to shake him. Shock him. I had to bring him out of his ideology. I had to say, "Yes, not that God exists." This was a response to that man's reality. Then somebody said, "Is there a God?" And he was a believer. And he believed in God. And I had to say no. I had to shake him too. And shock him too. And bring him out of his sleep. If I had said yes to him, he would have gone home thinking that Buddha agrees with him. Thinking that Buddha also believes in the same way he believes. Then his ideology would have been strengthened. And any ideology strengthened is a danger. All ideologies have to be shattered, utterly shattered. So a mind is completely free from ideology. I had to remain silent to one person. Because he was neither a theist nor an atheist. His question was very simple and innocent. He had no ideology. So I need not shock him. He was a really silent man. I kept silent. And he understood me. He understood the idea that about questions like God one should be silent. These are meaningless questions. Nothing to be said. Because whether you believe in God or you don't believe in God makes no difference. You don't change. Go and look. The person who believes in God and the person who does not believe in God, look into their life. Their life are the same. No difference at all. Somebody goes to the church, somebody goes to the temple, somebody to the mosque, but look into their life. No difference at all. So what is the point of believing? You will find a different quality of being when a person believes into nothing and drops all beliefs, and his consciousness is freed from all ideology, because every ideology becomes a fixation. A moralist is a man with fixation, and the religious man is flowing, fluid. The moralist has some ideas how to live your life. The religious person has no ideas how to live your life. He leaves it to Tao, to God, to whole. He surrenders to the whole, and the whole lives through him. He has no ideas how to live your life. Remember, if you have some ideas how to live your life, you will live wrongly. When somebody asks me what is the right way to live your life, I say the right way to live your life is not to have any ideas how to live your life. Live without ideas and you live rightly. Live without mind and you live rightly. Live moment to moment and you live rightly. Don't live out of the past and don't live out of the future. Just live here now and you live rightly. Now, this parable. The Sushya asked the master, what sort of man is Anhui? For kindness, he is a better man than I am. Now, about these four persons, the Sushya asked the master. These four are the master's disciples. They all serve him. But they must have been very famous people. Sometimes, outshining the master himself, and the problem must have been in many people's minds. Tazushi asked, what sort of man is Anhui? Anhui was a disciple, a famous disciple. And the master said, for kindness, he is a better man than I am. And what about the Zukung? For eloquence, he is a better man than I am. And the Zulu, for courage, he is a better man than I am. And the Zuchang, for dignity, he is a better man than I am. Now the master is saying that if you take different qualities and you compare, these people are better in some way or other from me. If you take individual characteristics, these people are better than me. Somebody is better as far as courage is concerned. Somebody is better as far as kindness is concerned. Somebody is better as far as eloquence is concerned. Somebody is better as far as dignity is concerned. Relatively, morally, these people are better than me. Tazusi arose from his mat and asked, he must have become very much puzzled. Then why do these four serve you? Then why? If these four people are better in some way than you, you should be serving them. Why they serve you? And the master said, sit down. I will tell you. This saying from the master, sit down, is very metaphorical. Doesn't see us standing up means he became excited. He became feverish. His mind was confused. 1001 thoughts started rumbling in him. He could not believe. Yes, this was true. What the master was saying was true. Everybody was feeling that these four people have great qualities. They outshine the master in some way or other. He must have become very much excited, curious. He forgot that in front of the master you are not supposed to stand. In front of the master you are not supposed to ask a question by standing. These are just symbols, symbolical, metaphorical things. When you ask a question to a master, you have to ask in a certain posture, bowing down, in a deep receptivity. The question should come from a very humble attitude. And the question should come from deep silence. Not in a perturbed mind, not out of disturbance, not out of excitement. It should come out of a quiet, silent mind, out of tranquility. The master said, sit down. The disciple must have forgotten. With the answer the master gave, he must have become really too much excited. He forgot that what he is doing, he must have acted in an unconscious way. The master says, sit down, first sit down. And it is not only for the body to sit down. The deep indication is towards the mind. Let the mind settle down. Only then you will be able to understand what I am going to say. That's what the master means when he says, sit down. And I will tell you. Remember, the mind can be in a state of deep settledness. Only then you are receptive. Otherwise, if the mind is stilled and there are clouds and dust arising all over, you are in a sort of a storm, how you are going to receive the master's answers? These are not philosophical discussions. These are penetrations into reality, into your own nature. And these questions, their asking and their answers are not meant just to satisfy curious people. One day it happened, a great philosopher came to Buddha. Buddha was sitting under a tree. This man Buddha must have loved trees tremendously. He is always sitting under it. He became enlightened under a tree. And you will be surprised. That is not such a big thing to become enlightened under a tree. Many people have become enlightened under a tree. But Buddha was born also under a tree. And he died also under a tree. He was a king's son, but he was not born in a palace. His mother was traveling, and they came to a garden, and suddenly the mother felt the pain arising, and there was no way. She got down. He was standing under the tree and Buddha was born. Then he became enlightened under a tree. And then when he was dying, he again lies down under a tree and dies under a tree. He must have loved the trees very much. For 500 years after him, the tree remained his symbol. For 500 years no statue was made. Just trees were painted. Trees were placed in temples. And people worshipped the trees. in a way very beautiful. I would like you to remind again, the tree is symbolic of religion because it grows, and it grows out of the innermost core. Buddha was sitting and this great philosopher came, and the philosopher said, "Have you said everything that you know?" Buddha had become very old, almost 80 years, and just within few months he will be gone. And the great philosopher has come from long away to inquire, "Have you said all that you know?" And Buddha took few dry leaves in his hand and asked the philosopher, "What do you think, sir? How many leaves I have got in my hand? Are they more than the dry leaves in this forest?" The whole forest was full of dry leaves. The paths were full of dry leaves. Wind was blowing here and there, and dry leaves were making much noise and much music. The philosopher looked and he said, "What type of question you are asking? How you can have more leaves in your hand? You have only few, a dozen at the most. And there are millions of leaves in this forest." And Buddha said, "So remember, that which I have said is only like the few leaves in my hand. And that which I have not said is like the leaves, dry leaves in this forest." The philosopher said, "Then one question more, why you have not said that?" Buddha said, "Because it will not help to attain nirvana. It will not help to meditate. That's why I have not said it. And moreover, it cannot be said. Even if I wanted to say, it cannot be said. You will have to experience and know it. It is experiences. It is existences." The master will say only something when he feels it is going to help your enlightenment. The master will say something only when he feels you are ready to receive. The master will say something only when he will see that the clarity is there and the mind is open. The transparency is there and you are ready with great humbleness and gratitude to receive it. You are not quarrelsome. You are not ready to discuss and debate. Only in great sympathy, in great love, when the disciple is enwrapped with the master, these things can be transferred. These are delicate things. The master says, "Sit down." Not only physically. Settle down inside. Don't get excited. I will tell you. In we can be kind, but cannot check the impulse when it will do no good. Now, this is the difference between religion and morality. Listen well. Sit down and listen well. Many of you are standing up. Sit down. And I will tell you. In we can be kind, but cannot check the impulse when it will do no good. Now, this kindness is not of awareness. One has to be capable sometimes not to be kind. The great kindness is capable of being kind and not to be kind, both. The great kindness is capable of being hard too. If your kindness is such that you cannot be otherwise, then it is not strength, it is weakness. If you cannot act otherwise, that simply means you are fixed. You are not fluid. Sometimes it is needed to be harsh. I have heard about the Zen masters, who was driving a woman and her child while snow was falling. And the snow was so much, and the morning was so cold, and there was no sun in the sky, it was so cloudy, that he himself started freezing, and the woman started freezing in the carriage. And by he saw that the woman is becoming blue, and she was losing consciousness. So he took away the child from the woman and pushed her out of the carriage and drove away. Now the woman was shocked, standing there in the falling snow, her child taken away. And what type of man is this? And he has taken the carriage. She started running and shouting and screaming and cursing. And within half a mile, she was perfectly okay, because running and cursing and shouting and screaming, he stopped the carriage and took her in. And he said, "Now it is okay. Otherwise, you would have died." Sometimes to be really kind implies that you can be unkind too. If you cannot be unkind, then your kindness is not of much worth. It is cultivated. It is not out of awareness. Now think, if you were the driver, you could not have done it. It looks immoral. But it is not. In Zen tradition, there are thousands of cases which look very immoral. Sometimes the master jumps on the disciple, beats the disciple, throws him out of the window. And the story says he becomes enlightened. When he falls out of the window, he becomes enlightened. To people who are not acquainted with the Zen methods, it looks absurd how a person can become enlightened. But you must be made alert that the disciple may have been working for 20 years, meditating, working, meditating, working. And the master finds one day that only a thin layer of unawareness is there, a very thin layer. And he watches the disciple and he cannot get through that thin layer. Remember, when the unconsciousness is very thick, you can fight with it. When it is very thin, it is very difficult to fight with it. When it is, there comes a moment, it is so thin that you think it is not there. It is almost like a transparent glass. It is so transparent, you don't see it. Then how can you fight it? Only the master can see it, that you are still behind a glass, seeing very clearly, almost as if there is no glass, but still you are behind a glass. In those moments, the master will be very hard. He will do something very shocking. In that shock, that thin layer will be broken. And only when it has broken, then you will be able to know that something was there in front of your eyes, not before. When it is gone, then you will understand that a thin layer was there, a thin film, which was so thin and so transparent that there was no way for you to know. Then you will feel thankful to the master. I will tell you, sit down. In way can be kind, but cannot check the impulse when it will do no good. Now, this kindness is impulsive. You are almost a victim. You are not the master of it. If you cannot help but be kind, it is impotency. In Japan, there exists a statue of Buddha, very rare statue, and of tremendous significance. One of my friends went to Japan and somebody gave him a replica, a plastic replica of the statue. The friend is a Jaina and he could not understand it because it looks a little illogical and unhistorical. In this statue, Buddha is having a sword in one of his hands. Sword. Buddha has never been heard to carry a sword. He was not a Muhammad, neither he was a Krishna. A sword. Buddha is having a sword in one of his hands. And the side of his face is so tremendously illuminated by the sword that the face looks as if it is not of a Buddha but of a Arjuna, a great soldier, a great warrior. The sharpness, the way of the expression of the face is such. In another hand he is carrying a lamp, a small earthen lamp, and on that side of the face he is so quiet, so silent, so Buddha-like. Now this is very absurd. When he came back from Japan and he showed me this statue, he said, "I cannot understand it. What does it mean?" I said, "It is very meaningful. It is a Zen expression. It shows your silence should be capable. Your silence should be strength too. And the lamp of peace should be capable of beginning a sword any moment it is needed that way. And the sword should be capable to become a lamp of peace any moment it is needed that way. One should be fluid and all the polarities should meet. A man is rich when all the polarities meet in him. When all the contradictions have lost their contradictions and have become friends, when you can befriend the contradictions, then you are really rich." This is the state of a religious man. The moral man chooses. The religious man lives in choicelessness. In who he can be kind but cannot check the impulse when it will do no good. Even when it will not do any good, or sometimes it may even do harm, then too he cannot check it. He is incapable of checking it. He is incapable of being responsive to the reality. He functions according to a principle. So the master says, for kindness, he is a better man than I am. But still, there is something missing in his kindness. He has moved too much to the extreme of kindness. He has lost balance. And a balanced man is the goal. Neither the bad nor the good, but one who is exactly in the middle, neither good nor bad, one who has transcended both and is capable of both whatsoever the situation demands. Listen to this point, the capacity to be all is the capacity of an religious person. Tazukun can be eloquent, but cannot hold his tongue. Now, if you can be eloquent and cannot be silent, your eloquence is meaningless. Unless words come out of silence, they are dead. Unless words come out of your inner emptiness, they are not full. When words come out of inner emptiness, they carry a fullness. When they come out of your silence, soaked with your silence, they have a music around them. They have a poetry and a life totally of their own. When you cannot be silent, you have to speak, and you cannot do otherwise, then your words are meaningless, gibberish. Then there is no poetry. Then they are very ordinary. Have you not watched it? Jesus speaks the same words that you speak. Buddha speaks and uses the same words that you speak. Then what is the difference? When you speak the same words, it carries no meaning, not at all. When Jesus speaks the same words, they are tremendously significant, so burning alive, so aflame with his vitality. From where they come? They come from his silence. Jesus used to go again and again into silence. Whenever he will come into the masses, 2 days he will talk to people, meet people, convert them towards God, and then one day suddenly he will say, now I will go to the mountains or to the desert. I would like to be silent. He will leave even his disciples. He will go alone into wilderness just to be silent. He has exhausted his silence. He has spoken. The silence is spent in words. Now he has to go back to be full again, to be full of silence. Then he will be full of poetry. Then he will be full of song. Then his words will not be ordinary words. Then those words will have a luminosity. Then they will hit and go directly into the heart. Remember, the words go exactly to the same depth from which they come. If my words come from my heart, they will touch your heart. If they come only from my head, they will touch only your head. It will depend. Have you seen an archer pulling his bow backwards? He pulls his bow backwards. The farther back he pulls the bow, the farther ahead will go the arrow. If the bow is not pulled back, the arrow will fall short. Deeper you pull your words into silence, back in your innermost core, the arrow goes far into the hearts of people. The master said, Tazukung can be eloquent, but cannot hold his tongue. Eloquence is of no importance as far as religion is concerned. Eloquence is important in politics. In religion, eloquence is secondary. The basic, the fundamental is silence. Words are secondary. Stillness is primary. If words come out of stillness, then they have some significance. If they don't come out of stillness, they are just rubbish. The master says, for eloquence he is better man than I am. But he makes the difference. He may have practiced eloquence, but he does not know what silence is. He cannot hold his tongue. Tazulu can be brave but cannot be cautious. When you are brave and cannot be cautious, you turn into a fool. You become foolhardy. You become a stupid. Bravery in itself is of no value. It can be suicidal. It can be murderous. Bravery in itself is of no value unless there is a light inside it of awareness, alertness. That's what cautiousness is. The Zulu can be brave but cannot be cautious. So his bravery is of not much use. Either he will create trouble for others or he will create trouble for himself. His bravery is not going to become a beneficial thing to anybody. Bravery is beneficial not because of bravery but because of cautiousness. Just look into these things. A simple parable, but the master is bringing what morality and religion are. If you practice eloquence, you will forget about silence. If you practice bravery, you will forget about cautiousness. If you practice kindness, you will forget that sometimes it is kind to be not to be kind. You will become fixed. You will have a pole, but the other pole will be missing. You will be half. You will not be whole. To be positive and negative together is what a religious man is. The immoral has chosen one pole, the negative pole. The moral has chosen another pole, the positive pole. The religious person lives in choicelessness. He has not chosen anything, but he uses all, whatsoever, the need. Sometimes he is as negative as the immoral, and sometimes he is as positive as the moral. But nothing holds him. He is not confined either to negativity or positivity. He is a free man. He has freedom. He uses all. And he is not used by anything. Tazuk Chang can be dignified but cannot unbend in company. You can be dignified. But your dignity can become an ego trip. And then you cannot bend. And with ego, how you can be really dignified? How ego can be a dignifying thing? How ego can give you grace? Then it will be just superficial posture. Empty, impotent posture. Then it will be just an empty, impotent gesture. Nothing inside. Just a container without any content. He can be dignified but cannot unbend in company. A man should be able sometimes to be undignified too. If you are always dignified, you cannot laugh. If you are always dignified, you cannot joke. If you are always dignified, you will become inhuman. You will lose all humanity. Have you not watched it? That people who sometimes can become undignified have more grace. A man, one who can laugh, laugh like a fool sometimes, has more wisdom than a person who is obsessed with wisdom and cannot laugh. He has to protect his wisdom. Continuously on guard. He cannot laugh. He cannot allow himself to laugh. because people will think that he is a fool. He is a fool. A wise man is capable of being sometimes foolish too. You must have heard that in old days, every great king used to have a fool in the court. The court fool. And you will be surprised, those were not ordinary fools. They were one of the most wisest men of those countries. The king used to have wise men and a fool too, to keep balance. Otherwise the wise people will make things so sober, dry, dull, sad. The whole joy will be lost. And sometimes you can become too serious. And the very seriousness can become a barrier in looking into things. The fool was needed. When things will be going too serious, he will do something or say something and bring the atmosphere back to human altitudes. He will do something. For example, one emperor was seriously thinking to turn the whole country into morality. Nobody should be allowed to say anything untrue. Untruth should be banned. And the wise people were all agreeing. And of course, those wise people were his servants, so they were even going ahead of him, exaggerating. And one wise man suggested that this is the right thing to be done. Untruth should be banished. And one who is found to be saying some untruth should be immediately sentenced to death. He should be hanged in the marketplace so that everybody knows that what will be the cost if you say anything untrue. The fool was listening. He said, okay. Then tomorrow morning I will see you all on the gate. He said, what do you mean? He said, on the gate. And he said to the king, keep a cross ready because I am going to say untruth. The king said, have you gone mad? He said, I have always been mad. But I will see you all, the whole court, and keep the cross ready. I will be the first person to be hanged. It was a challenge. The cross was kept ready. And tomorrow morning, when they opened the door of the town, the fool entered on his donkey. And the king asked, where are you going, you fool? He was very angry because so early morning they had to come there. And the fool said, I am going to the cross. Now he created a trouble. If you kill him, he has said a truth. If you don't kill him, he has said a lie. He said, I am going to the cross. Prepare the cross. I am going to die on the cross. Now all those wise people and the king were puzzled what to do with this man. He is saying a lie. If you kill him, the lie becomes truth. If you don't kill him, then the lie goes unpunished. And the fool laughed and he said, you are all fools. Who can ban untruth? And who can ban immorality? Everything is needed in proportion. Each great king used to have a fool, because wise people tend to go to the extreme. And to go to the extreme is a sort of foolishness. To keep balance. Sometimes to forget all about dignity. To bend in company. sometimes to laugh like a fool, sometimes to be like a child, and sometimes to be human. You go, you look at your Mahatmas, they are never human. They will not laugh, they will not joke, they will not do anything that can prove that they are human. They keep above humanity. Hence, if they are said, nothing is unexpected. If their eyes look dull and sad, if they look dead, it is natural. Tazu Chang can be dignified but cannot unbend in company. Even if I could have the virtues of the four men all together, I should be unwilling to exchange them for my own. Now listen to this tremendously important sentence. Even if I could have the virtues of the four men all together, I should be unwilling to exchange them for my own. Because that which is yours is true, and that which you take from others is untrue. The borrowed is never true. The borrowed, the imitated, is always false. Morality is imitation. Religion is always your own. On a rose bush comes the rose flower. Somewhere in a pond flowers the lotus. The lotus comes out of the lotus seeds. The rose comes out of the rose bush. The rose cannot borrow the lotus. The lotus cannot borrow the rose. When religion flowers, it is yours. When you try to be moral, you borrow. You imitate. You try to become a carbon copy of someone. A Christian is one who is trying to become a carbon copy of Christ. Hence, Christian is ugly. Christ is beautiful. Christ is a rose flower. Out of his own bush he has flowered. That was his crime. Jews did not like it. They wanted him to become a Moses. They wanted him to become a lotus flower. And he asserted his own. He said, I will be my own being. I will be myself. That was his crime. Jews could not forgive him. But Moses was a flower. Out of his own being. He was not imitating anybody. No religious person has been an imitator. Then all so-called religious people who are imitators are not religious at all. Never borrow. Even if your flower is small, it is good. It is yours. Even somebody else's flower is very big. Has much fragrance, has much color. Don't borrow it. Yours is good. It is your destiny. God wants you to flower in your own being. A great Hasid mystic was dying. His name was Lucia. Somebody around him said, Josiah, have you made peace with Moses? And Josiah opened his eyes and said, forget about everything about this Moses. Now this is not important. I am dying and you are talking nonsense. The man became afraid because what he is saying, a pious Jew at the time of death is saying, forget all about Moses. And Josiah says, listen, Now I am going to die and I will be facing God. He will not ask me, he will not say, Josiah, why you were not Moses? He will not ask me that. He will ask Josiah, why you were not Josiah? So forget all about Moses. At least in these last moments, leave me alone. Let me gather together my being so that I can stand before him, at least on my own feet. I have wasted my whole life, and now in the end, again you have come to ask, have you made your peace with Moses? What I have to do with Moses? If Moses has nothing to do with me, what I have to do with Moses? Sometimes people come to me and they say, do you agree with Buddha? I say, nonsense. He never agreed with me. So why should I bother to agree with him? He did his thing, I am doing mine. Where arises the question of agreeing? Why should you agree with anybody? If you can agree with yourself, you have agreed with God. Enough. More than enough. If you have agreed with yourself, if you have accepted your being, finished, your journey has come to an end. Now you can flower. The master said, even if I could have the virtues of the four men all together, I should be unwilling to exchange them for my own, because that will be a mechanical thing. To borrow one thing from one, another thing from anybody else, to borrow from so many people, it will be an assembly. It will be a mechanical thing. A car is to be assembled. A tree grows. The tree is the symbol of religion and the car is the symbol of morality. You can assemble a car. You can go into the market and purchase different parts from different places and assemble. You can make your own hodgepodge car. But you cannot assemble it. You cannot go into one garden, take one branch, into another garden, take another branch, flowers from somewhere, leaves from somewhere, roots from somewhere else. You cannot assemble a tree. The tree cannot be put together. You cannot assemble religion. Religion is not born out of an assembly line. I will be unwilling to exchange them for my own. This is why they serve me without misgivings. And they know it, that I have an organic unity. And they know it, that they have only mechanical unity. They know it, they have talents. But their talents are fixations. And they know that I have something from my inner coming to the outer. From the center, flowing towards my periphery. They know it. Hence they serve me without any misgivings. They are great in one way or other. But their greatness is dimensional. This is the last thing to be understood. A man of morality is dimensional, one dimensional. He moves in one dimension. The man of religion is non-dimensional. He has no dimension. All dimensions are available to him. A sportsman entered his horse in the Kentucky Derby. The horse won by 20 lengths. After the victory, the horse was entered in more than a dozen races at different tracks and came in last in every one. Puzzled, the sportsman took the horse to see a vet psychiatrist. After a thorough examination, the vet turned to the sportsman and said, this is a very simple case. The trouble with this horse is that he has a one-track mind. The morality is a one-track thing, one-dimensional. And the moral man becomes lopsided, because in one direction he moves, all other dimensions suffer. If you want to become too much kind, from where you are going to get the energy? From other dimensions. It is as if somebody's head becomes too big and the whole body shrinks and becomes small. Or somebody's legs become very big and the whole body shrinks and becomes small. That is the shape of a moral man. A religious man is an organic unity in balance. His head, his hands, his feet, his body, his mind, his soul, all are in a deep harmony, in a deep rhythm. He is an orchestra. This parable has to be meditated deeply. Remember always never to borrow. Remember always never to imitate. Remember always that you have to grow, not to condition yourself. You have to become a tree. You have to bloom like a tree. You are not to become an efficient mechanism. You have to become a tree so that your fragrance can be released to the winds. That will be your offering into the feet of God. And remember, he will ask Jusia why you are not Jusia. He will ask you why you missed your being. Why you have not arrived with your being to me. Why you missed your life in going after other people. I was always within your heart waiting for you, but you never came there. You went behind Moses, Muhammad, Mahavir, Krishna. You followed everybody. You looked in every nook and corner, and you never came into your own being. And I was sitting there waiting for you. When you come into your own being, you have come home. You have come to God. God is nothing but a name of your innermost core. Enough for today.